fear of an enemy, of a fiend, be it Amalek, be it the serpent, and be it simply the wilderness itself. Because the primitive man is afraid not only of living beings, but even of any phenomenon. Let me just read a few psukim. Vayisu bnei Yisroel esenehem, v'ne Mitzrayim nisei achareyem, v'yiru meid v'yitzaku. The children of Israel lifted their eyes, and they beheld the Egyptians marching after them. And they were so afraid, and the sons of Israel cried. Cried in the sense, it's not in the colloquial, typical colloquial cry, it means they protested. In Tzuek Yitzakol, I don't mean your cry, your protest. Tzoko in Hebrew is basically protest. Simply, fear prompted their protest. Then we read in the Torah, Vayaveyo Morosa, Vleyoch Lulich Tismai in the Morok, Kimorim Hein. Vayaveyo Omar Meisha Lema, Vayaveyo Mamishke. And when they came to Mara, they could not drink of the waters of Mara, for they were bitter, and the people murmured against Moses. Again, what prompted their protest? First. Now, when you come against me, Israel, our Mishir, Allah, and the Midbar, and Yemra, and the Israel, and the whole congregation of children of Israel murmured against Moses. Then we sat by the flesh pots, and then we did eat bread to satisfaction. We were hungry. A hungry person is an angry person. An angry person is not a silent person, but very loud. Vayisu kol hadas bnei Yisrael, vayachanu b'tfilin, v'imayim mishkeis, v'orom, v'yorev v'orom m'moshe, v'yimru, t'nu lanu mayim, v'nishke. And the congregation journeyed and encamped in Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people did quarrel with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. There were no political disagreements with Moses or ideological controversies. There were no rebellions. There was just protests, complaints, and calls. And all those protests, complaints, and calls were consequences of discomfort and hardship. We were subjected to the first and second year of this journey together. They wanted the water, they wanted food, they were afraid, they protested. Even the golden calf episode, the episode of the Eagle of Earth, was not precipitated by idolatrous ideas that corroded the moral fiber and influenced the philosophy of the people. No, not at all. The golden calf was precipitated by the primitive instinctual horror that befalls the lost sheep in the wilderness, in wide and open spaces. It was a spontaneous reaction to the primordial terror of the jungle. They were lost in the jungle. They thought Moses will never come back, and without Moses, what can they do? How can they survive in the jungle? It is the fear, the instinctual horror, not even, I shouldn't even use the term fear, the instinctual terror and horror which strikes this, the lost sheep, when the latter realizes that it has separated itself from the herd, from the flock. V'yak v'yikoy v'orom alari, kum asei lonu elohim, Kizeu ish Moshe, liodanu mehoyle. And the people assembled unto Aaron and said, make us a God who shall go before us, because we lost Moses. In a word, all the previous falls were unorganized, unplanned. Reactions, unplanned, spontaneous reactions to situations that they could not be confronted, that they had to confront, and they did not know how to confront such situations. They were generated, basically, the previous falls, by a mob mentality, which gets easily excited, but also can regain easily its equilibrium. The Korach controversy was of a totally different character. The rebellion was not due to ungratified physical desires, such as hunger and thirst. Not at all. Second, the crowd was not involved at all. The masses were not involved at all. The mob, which demanded from Aaron he should make them a god, the arm, which protested in the Philim, they are thirsty, they want water. The arm, which wanted to stone Moses and Aaron, I mean, during the Meraglim episode, was not involved at all. The mob did not participate in the anti-Moses campaign, if I may call it. Only individuals, the leadership consisted of several individuals. The followers, few hundred, most. Hamishim Masayinish, Makhtir Akhtir. All individuals, mostly of the intellectual elite, of the aristocracy, were involved. The Torah tells us, the Siyed, Fruimed, Ansheshen, princes of the congregation, called into the assembly, men of name. This was a rebellion, not just a quarrel, a rebellion. An organized movement, well planned and painstakingly prepared. In short, we should use a colloquial legal term of a Korach conspiracy. There was no conspiracy as far as the episode of the Meraglim is concerned. No conspiracy. Everything was spontaneous, unorganized, unplanned. The immediate reaction to fear, to the story about the giants. But in Korach it was a conspiracy, premeditated and carefully thought out. It was a real rebellion. Apparently, if we should trace, the history of that rebellion, what psychologically prompted it, what is the etiology of that rebellion, we should follow the Ramban. Ramban is excellent in this regard. Whatever I say here, about the background, you may find the Ramban if you study the Ramban carefully. Apparently, Korach's enmity was incurred by Moshe at the time of the elevation of Aaron to the high priesthood. Rashi quoted to the Midrash, the high priesthood and the appointment of the Levites as mere servants in the sanctuary, apparently. He didn't like it. However, but this happened a year before. However, Korach, in spite of the fact that he was angry, when Moshe incurred his enmity, did not attempt to come out publicly against Moshe, since he understood very well that the people, notwithstanding minor incidents, were devoted and loyal to their great leader, and that any attempt to unseat Moshe would be met with anger and derision. He waited here, patiently waited, for an opportunity, for an event that will somehow undermine Moses' position and his popularity. He waited for Watergate. He hated Moshe. He nursed this hatred, and he was hoping that the opportune moment will arrive. And, as a matter of fact, the opportune moment did arrive sooner than Kerach anticipated. The Meraglim incident. Perhaps this was the most tragic incident in Moshe's life. The Meraglim incident episode and the subsequent decree by the Almighty that all adults die in the desert was a hard blow to Moses' prestige in the eyes of the crowd. For a while, a short while, he lost the grip over the crowd. His grip over the crowd. He lost his influence. Moses promised on behalf of the Almighty. The slaves in Egypt, before they left Egypt, while they were still busy building barracks and fortresses for Pharaoh, he promised those slaves that they will enter into the promised land, into a land flowing with honey, with milk and honey. And they'll promise they'll enter the land a short time after the departure from Egypt. Indeed, when we read Bala Yisro, they were ready to invade the Negev the second year after following the Exodus. As it is related to us in Numbers 10:29, Vayimer Moshe v'chevor ben-ruel ha-midyoni chesen Moshe noisim anachno la-mokim asher omer ha-deshem esei etim lochem l'cho etano. We are journeying to the place which the Eternal said, I shall give to you. Come down with us. What place was Moshe talking about? The promised land. We're ready to enter. Of course, they wouldn't have entered Eretz Israel from the east, but from the Negev, from the south. Suddenly, like a lightning bolt of a clear blue sky, they are staying in the wilderness, who was extended for 39 more years. Suddenly, all the hopes, all the dreams, that soon will invade the land flowing with milk and honey, got dissipated, shattered. No land, no conquest, no rivers of milk and honey, no realization of the promise by Vasi. We were inside. It became a reality, suddenly became a vision. Many, many bleak and dreary years will have to pass before the soil will set its foot on the soil of Canaan, the promised land. Where is Moses' pledge? We ask each other. And Kerach liked those questions. Those questions were very encouraging to Kerach.
Oh,
you realize the time has arrived.
The air conditioning worked automatically here, or what?
Where is Moses' pledge? Where is his clairvoyance? Where is his prescience? Where is his prophecy?
I think we'll have to have it on from time to time.
When people used to talk with each other, how would it be possible to endure so much hardship in that dreary wilderness?
Okay, I have someone
here. 39, 40 years. The people complained, but it was a complaint of hopelessness. Moses' popularity was at a low ebb. Now, Kerach thought, the time has arrived, and I may reveal my plans to other people against whom Moshe discriminated. And Kerach started to recruit disgruntled and frustrated people and organized a formidable opposition to Moshe. More or less, the Ramban interprets it. Because when the Ibn Ezra said that the incident of Korach happened immediately after the construction of the Mishkan, Ramban said, no. It happened after the Meraglim episode. And that the Ramban is right, and the Ibn Ezra is wrong, we have proof, ample proof on the Pesukim. What did Dothan Vaviron tell Moshe when he sent for them and invited them to come over? Aflei aleret zovas cholo vudvosha veyison vatitel lonu nachlaso bevekarem. You didn't bring us into the land of honey and milk, and you did not give us a share in that land. It means your promise did not come true. Interesting is the word vayikach. The word vayikach was interpreted by Rashi in two ways. One way, it's a very obscure word. I mean, the semantics of the word is very obscure. One way, Rashi says, lokach es atzmei litzat echot. Li es nechlak mitecho edo. Le'ere ralak puhuna. Let me translate English, but I mean, the meaning is obscure. He betook himself on one side with the intention or view of separating himself from the community so that he may raise a protest regarding the priesthood. It's a verbal interpretation, translation of Rashi. What Rashi means, Kerach made the final lead. Until Kerach, no one dared to impugn Moshe's father. Right, people were angry, and he said, give us water, give us food. We remember the flesh part of Egypt. Yeah. But he stood in awe before Moshe. Kerach was the first one. Lokach es atzmei. He dared, for the first time, li'esnechlak mitecho edo, to separate himself from the community which was committed to Moshe, revered Moshe, loved him, in spite of everything, and was loyal to him. He was the first one. Le'ir ha'latum. I believe that lokach es atzmei, he took himself, means something else. He dedicated himself completely to that task. Vayikach Kerach es atzmei. He dedicated himself to this task. There was only one goal in Kerach's life. One goal. He was ready to sacrifice his life in order to achieve that goal. Name what? To unseat Moshe. To demote Moshe. He dedicated his whole self to this diabolical plan of undermining Moses' exalted position within the community. Vayikach means he committed himself totally to the implementation of the plan. However, it was an individual affair. He did not retain anybody else. He decided, he hated Moshe. He did not betray his hatred. He did not disclose to anybody. He waited. At the beginning, he did not reveal anything to the prospective conspirators. Yet, at the very instant, the divine decree condemning the Jews to 40 years sojourn in the wilderness was announced, Kerach immediately revealed his plans to Dothan Vaviron because he thought that the golden opportunity has offered itself. And Rashi did not have shot a Vayikach. Vayikach, Moshach, Roshi, Sanedroes, Shebohem, Bidvorim. First, he decided himself to fight against Moses, to defeat Moses, to remove him from this historical scene. Next, but he had no courage to reveal the plan to others. But following the incident with the Meravim, is Moshach Roshi Sanhedroes. He attracted the chiefs of the Sanhedrin, of the courts, by fine words, clever words, intelligent words. Chazal say, Tirach Shepikiach Oyem. Tirach was a clever, intelligent man. How did Chazal know about it? Because he made money, so he was a rich man. A rich man is not always a rich man, a clever man, intelligent man. And there are many stupid people who are rich. Because his arguments, are indicative of inner intelligence. So even the Rosh Sanhedrin, the heads of the court, he convinced that righteousness is an insult. And Rashi says, these fine words, he began to conspire. Now the conspiracy began. He began to conspire, to criticize, to attack, and to ridicule Moshe. Kerach used all the weapons of the arsenal of Rashi's and of conspiracy. To some, in conversation with some, he was serious. In conversation with others, he was humorous, sarcastic. In conversation with some, he played the role of the persecutor. In his conversation with others, he was the champion of justice. He was very capable. And he involved, interestingly, the Bnei Reuven. So Rashi says, why Bnei Reuven? Why the tribe of Reuven became involved so easily in the conspiracy? So Rashi says, Eilu Rosh HaVeilu Shechene. Next door neighbor of Kerach. So he met Kerach too often, too many times. Kerach succeeded in convincing. The Ramban already mentions it, that the Bnei Reuven had also a grudge against Moshe, against Jacob, but it didn't do anything to Jacob. So he transferred the grudge to Moshe, because Reuven was deprived of the Bechere, of Kehune and Levi and Moses. They also nursed a grudge against Moses. They also felt hurt because Moses took away the prayer from them, the privilege of Malchus and Tehune and Levi. However, any conspiracy or organized movement, in order to succeed, any rebellion, in order to make headway, no matter how egotistically this rebellion is motivated, in order to make headway, to succeed, must develop an ideology. If it's a spontaneous reaction, if two people quarrel, there is no need to develop a philosophy or to quarrel on behalf of ideas, to represent ideas. But if Korach, planned a movement, it was a movement, it was a conspiracy, it was an anti-Moses movement. So such a movement cannot exist, cannot succeed, without developing the proper ideology. A motto, any movement must have a motto. A motto is indispensable. And Kerach indeed did provide the philosophy of the rebellion. And the Torah is interested to tell us not only about the facts, the events that transpired, but also about the ideology which Kerach formulated. And simply, I believe, The Parsha is out to tell us the distinction or the difference between the Moshe's approach and Korach's approach to certain matters. Let us concentrate. Well, how will you, what would you say? How many arguments did the Korach employ? Other arguments, ideological arguments, in order to justify his attitude, his stand. How many? What would you say? How many? I believe there was only one argument. It branched out later, in several. But I'm going to investigate basically I'm going to investigate two arguments here. First, the argument which the Torah has related at the very beginning of the story. And second, an argument which the Torah has not mentioned at all, but somehow, in a mysterious way, we don't know how, Chazal has introduced the argument, you know, about the Tehillim. Let us concentrate first upon the most potent of all arguments that Korach advanced against Moses, namely with the argument which the Torah stated at the very beginning of the story. Vayikalu al Moshe val Aaron, vayimru aleihem rav lachem, ki choleido kulam gdeishim, ubeseichom Hashem, velomo tisnatsu al kal Hashem. You've gone too far, for all the community is holy, all of them are holy, and the Lord is in their midst. Why then do you raise yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? It is a solid argument. Thus, the problem of leadership and exercise of power was raised. Korach thought, apparently, that Moshe seized power illegitimately. He usurped power. That Moses is a usurpator. He impugned Moses' authority. He challenged Moses' authority. And the basis of this challenge was very simple. And at first glance, quite logical. No one can deny Korach's assertion that the whole community is holy. Is it a lie? Is it a lie that Korach said? Yes. And that every Jew possesses intrinsic sanctity and inner charismatic quality, elevating him above others. No one can deny it. This is the very essence of Tzilas Yisrael. As far as covenantal choiceness and holiness are concerned, I mean, Kedushas Israel, there is no distinction. There was no distinction between Moses and the woodchopper, between Moses and the wood and the water drawer. Not at all. No matter how simple the woodchopper is, no matter how great in spirit Moshe was. Hence, Korach asks, and the question merits an answer, what right did Moses or Aaron have to lead, to guide, to rule? It is the age-old or millennia-old question pertaining to the principle of equality of man versus election and singling out of an individual. Let us analyze this argument. Korach was wrong. This is an absolute postulate. Korach was wrong because he was unaware of the twofold character of Kedushas Yisrael. Having known the mystery of the dual Kedusha idea, he would not have advanced the argument. What is this twofold Kedusha idea? What am I referring to? And here I must introduce a Rashi in Deuteronomy in Dvorim. I have the Rashi mentioned once in my Shuvah Shurim, but however I have interpreted the Rashi quite differently than I'm going to do tonight. So I'm not plagiarizing myself. Ki am kodesh atol adishem rekecho. It's a pasuk in Re'eh. U'bocho bochar adishem. Mi Yisrael le'am zgulo. Rashi adds a few words. Ki am kodesh atol v'dushas atzmecho me'agisecho. Ve'eid b'cho bochar adishem. Very cryptic, Rashi. Ki am kodesh ato, because Rashi apparently could not understand why the Torah did duplication in the puzzle. If the Torah said ki am kodesh ato la'ashem lekecho, why does the Torah have to continue say ubecho bochar adishem li yisrael la'am zgulo? Rashi couldn't understand it. So Rashi said the Torah has formulated here two ideas of kedusha. Ki am kodesh ato. Gdushas atzmecho ma'avei sechu v'yeid moreover b'cho bochar ad Hashem elekecho. Let me just translate to English. Thou art holy, your holiness comes to you from your fathers. Gdushas atzmecho ma'avei sechu v'yeid b'cho bochar. But in addition to that gdushay, the Lord has chosen thee to be a cherished people unto himself. In other words, Rashi apparently thought that there is a twofold idea of Kedushas Yisrael. First, the community as a whole is holy, as an entity. Many times in my lectures, I try to simply put across the idea that Knesset Yisrael is not just a herd, not just a crowd, not just a conglomerate of people, not just a multitude of souls, but it is individuality, it's an entity, it is a personality, a living personality. Knesset Yisrael as a whole. First, the community for which we have the most beautiful term, Knesset Yisrael, the Ramban speaks about that term in Parshas Chayisora, the most beautiful term, Knesset Yisrael, the community as a whole is holy. This Kedusha of the community, the covenantal community, is inherited from our ancestors. In other words, there is a genetic code of Kedusha. You know what the genetic code is? So we think genetic biological, all of these in terms of a biological genetic code. Rashi knew of another genetic code of Kedusha, which is transmitted most probably through the genes. Or transmitted to the soul, I don't care. Yeah. But it means it is a genetic code of this. Otherwise you cannot speak of inheritance. And that's the reason that if a baby is born to a Jewish mother, willingly the baby is considered Jewish. This is Kiyam Kodesh Atol Adeshem Erkech. The baby is a member of the community. The community bestows Kedusha on the baby. This Kedusha is inherited from our forefathers. The community is consecrated as a unitary entity, as a whole. The individual, in order to lay claim to Kedusha, must draw upon the resources of Gdusha available to the community. I am holy because I belong to a community. I am united with a community. I am affiliated with a community. And that community happens to be holy as a whole. So if the whole is holy, if the parts comprising the whole are also endowed with sanctity. The Gdusha, this Gdusha, Kiyam, the father's Kiyam, Kodesh, after Ladeshem Melekeha. You are holy as a what? As a people, as a nation, as a community. You know what Am means in Hebrew? Am in Hebrew means Im, together. By being together, you are holy. It's not a separate holiness. It's not individual holiness. It's not a personal holiness. It's a together holiness. This Gdusha is not a personal, intimate, but a universal, community-rooted, and community-nourished and centered Gdusha. I am holy because I'm a child of a people who inherited Gdusha from its progenitors. In light of this theory, we establish, or this theory establishes, the supremacy of what? Of community over individual. You know, it's no controversy among philosophers. Whom should supremacy be assigned? The individual over the community, or the community over the individual? You know very well the American social philosophy, since the days of Jefferson, has clung stubbornly to the idea that the individual reigns supreme. But however, from the viewpoint of Kiyam Kodesh after Ladeshem Melekeha, seeing this controversy from the viewpoint of Am Kodesh after Ladeshem Melekeha, we may say that the others did not agree with Jefferson or the French encyclopedist philosophers of the Age of Reason, Montesquieu, so on. It has established the supremacy of the community over the individual. The community is of primary. The individual is of secondary significance. Again, the community is placed above the individual person. Kiyam Kodesh ato ladechem melekeha. As a matter of fact, Marxism, subscribes to this theory that the community is above the individual. You are consecrated to me as a people, as a nation, as a community. The individual Gdusha is derived from that of the community. Hence, all Gdushot are commensurate and not equal. If the individual derives his Gdusha from the community, so Moshe derived as much Gdusha from the community as the woodchopper did. Here justice prevails. Here is an absolute democratic approach to the partition of Gdusha. There is no differentiation of Gdusha from the viewpoint of the Am Kodesh at all of the Shemlaker. However, Yahadus was not too happy with that. Not satisfied with this social aspect of Gdusha. Because this aspect, if accepted as the only source of Gdusha, if the community is the only source of Gdusha, then the individual would be deprived of his creative role, of his individual initiative, of his originality and uniqueness. If there is one Gdusha, and only one, rooted in the community, and all individuals receive share per share alike, then the genius cannot be created. The outstanding person cannot develop into a great money, because there is the partition of producers. Our life is shared to share alike. Hence the Torah said that in addition to the community Kedusha, Am Kodesh Atol HaLishem Lekecho, there is another resource of Kedusha. Where is this resource of Kedusha to be found? In the individual. The individual must discover in himself this resource of Kedusha. The Kedusha which the individual detects in the inner resources of his personality is already personalistic, single, unique. He has Kedusha, no one has the Kedusha like his. There is no share. Individual Kedusha cannot be shared with somebody else. It's mine, completely mine, exclusively mine. I could paraphrase the Mama Chazal, Hashem Shepartaseyem Shalbnei Odom, Meshunim Zemezeh, Kar Deeseyem. I could paraphrase and say, Kishim Shedeeseyem Shalbnei Odom, Meshunis Zemezeh, Kach Bedusheseyem Meshunis. From this viewpoint, the community derives what? Kedusha from the individual. The Kedusha Seom is integrated of the countless Kedusha experiences of the individual members of that community. Just the reverse of the previous Kedusha. The single person sanctifies the community. How beautifully did the Torah state, Kiyam Kodesh Atol HaLishem Lekecha. Of course you are holy because you are a member of a holy nation, because you are a particle or a component part of a great holy community. But at the same time, Ubecho Bochar HaLishem Li Yisrael Am Zgulo. We have the Lord chosen to form a treasured people. There is a separate Kedusha attached to thee as an individual, as a single person. Ubechor Bochar HaDeshem Lios. What does it mean, Lios? Ubechor is, if the Torah addresses itself to the individual. So how will you say it in English? Ubechor Bochar HaDeshem. And God has charged thee with the mission. What? Lios. What does it mean, Lios? To form. To create. And a treasure of people. Before, the people precede the individual. Now, the individual precedes the people. And we have the Lord chosen to fulfill a mission. Namely, what mission? Leos, to form or to create or to organize an Amzgulo. We ourselves, the connotation in this context of forming, constituting, or creating an Am's Gulor. It is obvious that as far as the Pchiras Yechidim is concerned, as far as the election of the individuals is concerned, the endowment cannot be equal. Each individual receives the endowment which what? Which is reflects the greatness of his personality. The individual Kedusha the individual Kedusha experiences are incommensurate and completely proportionate to the individual's involvement, dedication, and to the individual's depth and sleep. The Kedusha is an expression of his greatness. And not all people are alike as far as greatness is concerned. The statement by Korach, Ki Cholo Eid Okumam Gedeshim, is correct. as long as we are speaking. Inherited from our ancestors. Moses was born into a Jewish community, and the baby of a slave was born in a Jewish community. The deceased share and share alike. Their shares in the endowment of sanctity were equal. However, when we shift our attention from the social aspect to the individual aspect of Kedusha, the whole idea of equality turns into an absurdity. Kiach said, Kichol Eido Kulom Gdeshim, when we say from Adishem, he emphasized the term Eido. The words Kichol Eido should be translated as the entirety of the congregation. The whole of the congregation is the source of Kedusha. However, he forgot that there is another aspect of Kedusha, the private, individual one. From that standpoint, from the standpoint of Kiyam Kodesh, Atola Hashem Lekecho, Korach's argument would have been a solid one. Yet under the aspect, Ubecho Bochar Ad Hashem Lekecho. So you have to admit that Pchiras Meise is above and beyond the Pchira of the woodchopper or the water drawer. Interesting is Meisha's answer. What did Meisha answer here? Baker the Yeda Ad Hashem Eis HaShalei Ve'es HaKodesh V'Yikriveyov Ve'es HaShayit HaBei Yakriveyov. It's a cryptic, mysterious answer. Come on in. The Lord will make known who is His and who is holy, and He will grant Him access to Himself. He will grant access to the one He has chosen. Moses speaks not of a congregation. Kira speaks of a congregation. Kichol Eido Kulam Gdeshim. Kira speaks of a congregation. Kichol Eido Kulam Gdeshim. The whole is holy. The part derives its Kedusha from the whole. Your Kedusha is transmitted by the whole to its component parts. Meisha speaks. The Yeda Adishem Meisha Shalei. He speaks about private persons. Moses speaks not of a congregation, but as an individual. Almost the same terms as the Torah speaks in Rei. Ubechob bochar Adishem. Yekorach. Choleida kulagdeshim, from that viewpoint you are right. But they know the viewpoint of Dushay. Ve'isa sheyifcha be'yakreveroth. And as far as prayer is concerned, individual prayer, personalistic prayer is concerned, there is a difference between individual and individual. Interesting, Mesh says Baker. Baker v'yed Adishem. Come morning, and the Lord will make known. You know very well what Radak, Ramban, Rid Mezre, Daor, there's not a single Mefarish which has omitted this explanation. Baker in Hebrew, according to the medieval grammarians, has the connotation of discriminating, differentiating, leyucha levakeir, ben asnuo, ben ahuvo, ben asnuo. Or leyucha levakeir, ben teiv lara. The differentiating between individual forms, Baker means the period of recognition. And this is not, I would say, drush, homiletics. That interpretation was advanced by the Radak, by the Ramban, by the Nezra, by the greatest grammarians of the Middle Ages. Baker means the period of recognition, identification of things, events, and people. Erev, in contradistinction, is the time of monotony, uniformity. Erev, they say the Radak, is like Arev, Taharuvis, mixture, merger, oneness. The time of apprehension, Erev is the time of apprehending the surroundings as one amorphous, formless mass, when all tzurot, all forms, all individuals merge into one homogeneous black reality. In the darkness, what do you see? Just a black reality, a black something. Korach, Moshe said to him, your concept of Dusha is identical with the Erev, with the bleakness of an autumnal night, whose darkness and drearness envelops everything. All you see is one piece of formless reality called Eido, called it. You don't see individuals. Your Dusha is Erev. Your concept of Dusha is limited to what Aristotle used to call to the Hilei, to some amorphous mass, to what the medieval philosophers called Chimerae Iuli, to the primordial mixture, a leveling off of specific individual traits. Of course, from the viewpoint of Erev, your argument is valid. However, there is another idea of the holy, the personal individualistic holiness, in which the human personality, with all its singular greatness and beauty, participates. This is the holiness of the morning. Baker, the Vedic tradition. This is the holiness which discriminates, the holiness which sees individuals, in each individual in the world for himself. It is the holiness which does not look upon the world as a one black, formless mass. What is it? Colorful. Colorful. A world full of song, joy, and individual freedom, and individual greatness. This is the holiness of the mornings, when the world emerges from the nightly anonymity into the individuated, distinct, morphological existence. As far as this holiness is concerned, the crowd is far below the individual. Each person is consecrated to a unique task that only he can perform. I believe that if you'll...
It's doing all right.
As a matter of fact, Gerus is not a popular subject now. With its two basic performances, or acts, Mila and Tfile, symbolically represent the two dimensions of the system. The universal, community-rooted concept of Dusha, and the individual concept of Dusha. The convert must attain both aspects. The community-rooted social Dusha, as well as the individualistic, personalistic Dusha. The Miller circumcision unites the convert with the community, with the people or nation. Through Mille, the girl becomes integrated into the community. Basically, Mille is the sign of identity.
Voice is across.
Will you stop
fooling around and
sit down? Sit down and listen. The Mille unites the girl with the community, with the people or nation. Through Mille, the girl becomes integrated into the community, and by so doing, is given the opportunity to draw upon the communal social resources of Dusha and to be a component part of the community. However, the personal element of Dusha is still missing. There can be no conversion without the acquisition of Dusha at both levels. Therefore,
Theory was introduced. Theory is indicative of personal commitment. The act of theory is inseparably linked up, whoever studied Jeromus once, this Kabbalah's El Mitzvah, you know very well. When does the Ger accept Kabbalah's El Mitzvah? Directly. What is Kabbalah's El Mitzvah? It's not a personal commitment to God. Not through the community, not through the community, but a personal commitment on the part of the convert to God. There the convert and God face each other. The convert commits himself. The personal individual election is attainable only after the girl separates himself from the community for a short time, retreats into isolation, hiding in the waters, immersion, and accepts responsibility not as a member of the community. That kind of responsibility accepted at the ceremony of circumcision. But now he accepts responsibility as an individual. Now I want to add something. It's also important to know. Kirach charged that Moshe and Aaron were power hungry. They intentionally set up a power structure and raised themselves above the congregation. What always angers me is the arrogant words by Kirach. V'lomo tisnasu al kala deshem. Tisnasu, you know what in Hebrew is nothing means? To raise one. Tadinyo berchagis. It's nothing linear. And the claims are unfounded. The same as that. Kirach was wrong. He simply did not understand the philosophy of power and leadership that Yehadus has developed. He identified the exercise of power with kingship. And the community which is subjected to a power structure, he identified as politeia, or as the political community, or as the state. He was wrong in that. This equation of leader and king and the politicization of the relationship between the leader and those whom he leads. This was the equation of leader and king and the relationship between the leader and those who are led. And that is again equated as a political relationship. These two equations are one. The covenantal community, and believe me, and this is true, I mean, and every Jew should know that. The covenantal community is first and foremost not a political community. I mean, Kilner would never admit it. It is a teaching community. The central figure in the covenantal community throughout the ages of millennia was not the king. Never the king, nor the warrior, nor high priest, but the teacher, the rabbi. The people are not subjects, as it is customary in the political community. The people in the covenantal community are disciples. The relationship is not of a political nature. It is not rooted in violence, because any political community must use violence. A political community cannot exist without the use of violence. nor is it connected with the application of sanctions. It is a free commitment on the part of the disciples to their master and teacher. The latter did not impose any authority upon the disciples. No one asked them to obey his words and to follow him. We can terminate this relationship at any time, the disciple. On the part of the disciples to their master and teacher, the latter did not impose any authority. The latter did not impose any authority upon the disciples. No one asked them to obey his words and to follow him. We can terminate this relationship at any time, the disciple. You cannot terminate, it's very hard to terminate a political relationship. You know what happened in America during the Civil War, when the states and the sovereign states wanted to terminate a political relationship. Judaism has disapproved, basically, of all forms of human government. There are definite streaks, but I want you not to misunderstand me. There are definite streaks of political anarchism in our reluctance to recognize man as king. Man, at best, is a Melech Avyein. And one of the topics of Rosh Hashanah is to contrast Melech Elyein and Melech Avyein. And by so contrasting, we condemn Melech Avyein. Melech Avyein is a plaza, nothing else. A daydreamer. Because there is no Melech Avyein. Because Melech Avyein is a contradictio in adjecto. God governs. No one else must usurp this prerogative. The only power structure that the Halacha or Judaism has accepted is the non-institutionalized relationship prevailing between teacher and pupil within the teaching covenantal community. Moshe is not known to us as king, even though he was king, by Yibishur Melech. He is known as Rebbe, Meshe Rabbeinu. He is known to us as the greatest of all teachers, as the teacher par excellence. The father of all prophets, even though he was also king, warrior, etc. Aaron is not just a high priest. He is the great teacher. Kisif Sekei Yishmorodav. The Torah Yevakshu Mipiyem. The priests themselves are not just charismatic personalities. Their sanctity is associated with the teaching they engaged. Uvosra lakei asheyir vayom imoel. The disciples love their master and listen not to his orders, since he gives none, but to his teachings, which enlighten their minds and gladden their hearts. Moses did not raise himself above the community, as Korach stated and Korach thought, but he was raised by the community above itself. It was raised by the congregation to the exalted heights as a spiritual, not political malchut. And as a matter of fact, spiritual malchut is by far more powerful and more enduring than political malchut. The reflexi forum, the lomotis naso, is out of context, was wrong. Moses was elevated without questing for leadership. He was not a misnase, but a nosu, or niso.
leader who is the great teacher. He is the holy man. The teacher is faithfully elected by God to be near him, and his personal Kedusha transcends that of his disciples. Kedusha, there is a question. Kedusha, teaching. The saintly person is the leader and at the same time, because he is the teacher. Now let us pick up this second argument of Kerr. The second argument of Korach has not been mentioned in the Bible. Rashi quotes from Tanhumei and tells us the following humorous story. Bomat zikinis reish nun roshes sanhedrios v'ulbishon talises shekulon treles bov v'omdu lifnemeshe omru lei talis shekulon treles chayeves bitzitzis epitura. אמר להם, חייבת, הסחילו לצחי קולות, איך שהטל של מנחם, חותכות של תחילס פטרו, זו שכולו תחילס, ותפטר את עצמו, היא עטיירת קרח, 250 צ'יפס על דקורות, על סהרן, עם רואו פסף תחילס, פרפו, בלו, אני לא יודע, פרפו וורד, בפרפו וורד. Then, became and stood before Moses, and said to him, is a garment that is entirely of purple subject to the law of tzitzis, or is it exempt? It is subject to the law, answered Moshe. Moshe was alarmed. Certainly. Is it asking you, I would also say, subject. Whereupon they began to jeer at him. Is it possible? Is this possible? They asked. A robe of any different colored material, one thread of purple. If you attach one thread of purple, it is exempted from the obligation of tzitzis. And the robe that is entirely of purple should not be exempt. The Midrash tells us another story, which is similar to death of Tchelis. Namely, they ask Moshe a second question. Should one attach a mezuzah to the doorpost of a house filled with skulls, the Sifrei Torah? Moses answered in the affirmative, of course. They jeered again and said, is it possible the two short sections, Shema Vohim Shomea, are enough in order to exempt the house from the obligation of mezuzah, while a multitude of Sifrei Torah does not exempt the house from chivas mezuzah? What is the Medrash out to tell us about these two stories? These stories are similar. The motif is identical. And what is the Medrash out to tell us? Apparently the Medrash felt these two stories, first, which have a touch of sarcasm and humor as well, will reflect the whole philosophy of Kerach and what he wanted. You see, as I told you, Kerach developed an ideology. He had a substitute for Terah's mission. He wanted to achieve something, because he wanted to take over. But the Medrash, who wants to bring out, by relating to us, this sarcastically, in good humor at least, these two stories, is, I believe, is obvious. And I would ask people to give me attention, because it's very important. Important as far as our times are concerned. Kerach rebelled against authority. All Jews are equal. Hence, everyone is entitled to interpret the law. It was a question of interpretation of the law. You see, that's why the Midrash introduced the story about the Tchelis, about the Mezuzah. Because Kerach not only wanted political power, he wanted to remove Moshe from office and succeed Moshe as king. No! He wanted to succeed Moshe as Rebbe. That generations, countless generations afterward, should say Kirach Rabbeinu. That was his ambition.
Doesn't sound right.
Yeah, don't sound right. That was his ambition, you understand? So hence, he's not only impugned and challenged Moses' authority as king, political authority, but he challenged his halachic authority. Can Moshe interpret the law? Is Moshe alone? The study of the law, to Korach, and to show unto them, and to show to the people, to the 250 scholars, the chief justices, that Moshe is incapable of interpreting the law. So he posed to Moshe those two questions. Moshe answered in the affirmative, while the 250 scholars, I don't know, I wouldn't have given them smire, but these 250 scholars have decided that Moshe is wrong. Not only Moshe is wrong, they jeered at him, they laughed at him. It was to them nonsense, absurdity. The study of the law, apparently, Kerach argued, the study of the law and its interpretation, Kerach argued, are exoteric acts, democratic acts, in which every intelligent person may engage. Moses' claim to being the exclusive legal authority and exclusive interpreter of the law, Kerach argues, are unfounded and unwarranted. The consequence of such a democratic philosophy is obvious. What Kerach wanted, and what many want even now, and I'm not speaking only about dissident groups, and I'm speaking about the Orthodox community, what Kerach wanted, and what many dissident groups want now, whether they state it clearly or they use equivocal terms and dubious language to cover it up, is that the instrument of interpretation of the Torah be common sense. Or the everyday empirical intelligence, not the esoteric conceptualizing logos, which can only be attained through painstaking study and hard training. In Hebrew, we have three terms which signify the human intellectual gesture. We all know Chochma Bina Das. I'm not going to analyze those three terms, but I want to show you just one distinction. Das denotes, particularly in Talmudic language, common sense. Not wisdom, common sense. Sound practical judgment. We come across the expressions Ben Das, as Ben Das me, an average intelligent person, not an idiot. Or the Nitrofodite, what does Nitrofodite mean? He lost his reason, I mean reasonableness. You're correct. A person deprived of Das is an idiot, senseless, foolish. In contradistinction to Das, Chochma Bina refer to scholarship, to specialized knowledge, to a trained logos, to an intellect which was subjected to training and criticism for a long time, to the precise, exact intellect. The Korach group pleaded the case of common sense or Das. They argued that every Jew with common sense should have the right to interpret the laws of the Torah and determine halachic matters in categories of common sense categories. There are different categories of common sense. As a matter of fact, like Gerach, the ritual to meet us in the non-Orthodox synagogues, or perhaps even in Orthodox synagogues, employ common sense in reaching halachic decisions. In fact, all the foreign movements, from the Tzedukim during the Second Commonwealth down to religious liberalism of today, pleaded the cause of common sense as the instrument of interpretation. I'll give you an example. The Tzedukim of old said, the Mishneh Yedayim tells us, that the daughter inherits the estate of the father if the son died and left only a daughter. If there is a problem, if there is litigation between the daughter of the father and the granddaughter of the father, then the daughter of the father should get the estate. You know what the Purushim said? Purushim said that if there is litigation between the daughter of the father, of the deceased father, and the granddaughter, who gets the estate? The granddaughter. The Purushim kept on arguing that it would be unjust to discriminate against the legitimate rights of the daughter of the deceased. The Tzedukim kept on arguing that it would be unjust to discriminate against the legitimate rights of the daughter of the deceased if the heir on the opposite side, its opposite number, is also a daughter, but not the daughter of the father, but a daughter of the son. Why should the real daughter surrender the estate to a granddaughter who is not as closely related to the father as she is? What do you say about it? From the viewpoint of common sense, of the exoteric empirical intelligence, that took him right.
Where?
Well, it makes a great deal of sense. How? In fact, under the aspect of common sense, or the lay practical approach, Kirach's argument against Moshe's decision was also valid. If one purple thread is sufficient, why should a purple garment require it? If one can fulfill mitzvah's mezuzah by attaching two parshiot to the door, why should not the presence of many scrolls in the house exempt the latter from the need of a mezuzah? However, and this is basically now a trend in the Jewish communities, in the Orthodox communities, to introduce common sense as an instrument of interpretation. I know what I'm talking about. Some here, I believe, would understand me. However, Torah Shabbat Peh cannot be identified with common sense, with Das, that is Chochmah. It has a methodology of its own. It has a singular approach. It has a distinct form of analysis. It has its own categories and its own strange schemata. Fundamentally, the Torah Shabbat Peh avails itself of a method of conceptualization. Whoever knows what Torah Shabbat Peh is and the method of teaching Torah Shabbat Peh, particularly the method which was forged by Rabbi Krieger, for some say that, Rabbi Krieger, says the Sivis of Chaim Brisker. Chaim Brisker actually has developed this method to dizzying height. Is Lomdes, basically, what do you call Lomdes? Consists in the ability to conceptualize Yalach. We conceptualize Sukkah, we conceptualize Besa B'cholav, we conceptualize Tarumis, we conceptualize the whole Torah. The halacha works like the mathematician in an a priori world. Its constructs are ideal. Torah Shabbat Peh does not study reality. It prepares abstract schemata and applies them to the world of sense. Now, I'll give you an example. In fact, Aristotle and the entire Greek science, which unfortunately dominated the Western world throughout the antiquity and the Middle Ages failed miserably. Aristotelian physics, I don't say Aristotelian philosophy, Aristotelian logic, but Aristotelian physics failed miserably. You know why? Because its foundation was common sense. The empirical human intelligence, which operates with usually with platitudes and commonplace ideas. The great accomplishment of Galileo and Newton consisted in replacing the practical common sense approach with a conceptualizing creative logos. With that, we all call now the scientific logos. What is scientific logos? What's the difference in scientific logos and the lay logos? Of course, the scientific logos is trained. The lay logos is not trained. Scientific logos is precise. The lay logos is not precise. But what is the main difference? The main difference, the scientific logos conceptualizes reality, while the lay logos, or the common sense logos, takes reality at its face value. They proclaimed the principle, Galileo and Newton, of mathematization and quantification of reality, of converting sense qualities like heat, like light, color, like sound, into quantitative relations, mathematical relations. Now, I'll give you an example. Aristotle, for instance, said, all things fall downwards because they are heavy. You see, in other words, he considered the gravitational pull as a result of heaviness or weight. This is nonsense. The reverse is true. Weight is the consequence of the gravitational pull. Newton discarded common sense and approached the matter from the viewpoint of the esoteric, abstract, creative, conceptualizing logos, and came up with his famous formula, gravitation equals the product of both masses over the square of the distance, mm over d or d in the second potency. In other words, gravitational pull is nothing but a mathematical relation between two bodies, which consists of the product of the masses over the square of the distance. This method of quantification was perhaps the greatest discovery in the annals of mankind. Of course, if we had been satisfied, not we, but in the 17th century, had been satisfied with Aristotelian physics, we couldn't climb now to the moon. Farewell. Don't you think that Allah is also entitled to such a prerogative? We have, as I stated above, our unique logical and epistemological approach to halacha. Basically, Torah Shebaal Peh is not just a compilation of laws. It is a compilation of laws, but it's more than that. Mathematics is not just a corpus of equations. Ask any mathematician who is intelligent, not stupid. What is math? He wouldn't tell you it's a corpus of equations. Or no physicist who understands physics. No physicist will tell you that physics is a collection of natural laws or equations. Basically, science is a method. Mathematics is a method. Physics is a method. It's a method of thinking. A unique logos. So is the Torah Shebaal Peh. The laws and statutes have utmost significance. However, if you discard the view that Torah Shebaal Peh is a system of thought structures and logical categories, unique logical categories, which are accessible to the mind, to the human mind, only if the latter is ready to subject itself to a rigid and tough training, then you open up the floodgate and any ignoramus may claim authority the way Korach did. I'll give you an example, for instance. You know now the movement of the women lit. All right, and the complaints against Torah Shabbat Peh, against our halacha. Halacha has discriminated against the woman. The woman is not an equal of men in the halacha. That's what I hear. And then the rabbis are ready to surrender. Right. In order to please a few ladies of the women lit. Basically, whoever studied Chumash knows Chumash well. Whoever studied the Gemara knows this discharge is sheer libel. Since the Chumash in Bereishis says that God created man, Zohar and Kiva boys, Bitzalim and Elikim boys, that men and women were created in the image of God, equality is taken for granted. If two creatures, if two personas are created in the image of God, you cannot say one is superior to the other. So people come out always and say, why is women postulators disqualified to bear witness? This qualification to bear witness is completely, if you speak in terms of Korach, of common sense, or Aristotelian terms of common sense, it's a good argument. Since at the wedding I'll look for another witness. I'm one witness, kosher ladies, and I look many a time. I look for another witness, and I don't find it. Quite often I can't find another witness who is a shema mitzvah, and I don't invite a woman to witness the ceremony and sanction the ceremony. Apparently she's inferior to the male. It is not correct. If the Melech HaMashiach were present at the wedding, I wouldn't invite him either, because he's also disqualified to bear witness. But will you say that all Jews are superior to the Melech HaMashiach? King Messiah, king, is disqualified to bear witness, like a Isha. Will you say that King Messiah, or King David, or King Solomon, or Moshe Rabbeinu himself, we are disqualified to bear witness? A man of his postulators, I can't help it. Would you derive on me the conclusions of it? That David, Moses, and a wood chopper, an ignorant person, a boom in the eyes of his postulators, if he observes the mitzvahs. Will he say that the postulators can be translated into axiological terms, and the conclusion would be warranted and justified to say that the King Messiah, the Melech HaMashiach, is inferior to some ignorant Jew? If you operate these common sense categories, yes. Kerach operated these common sense categories, and he was right in his conclusion that a talis tredus, if the robe, the whole robe is made of purple material, certainly should be exempt from the need of Jesus. But from the viewpoint of the exact, precise, and unique halachic categories, from the viewpoint of such halachic such structure, is Eides has up is not indicative at all of the station of the woman in society, in the halachic community. The same is true about the minyan. We don't count a woman. But does it mean that the woman is inferior? It's very strange. I said it in my yard, that the greatest teacher of all pertaining to prayer was a woman. The Gemara says it's not for Chaneh, who you wouldn't be able to pray. So Chaneh was the greatest of all teachers pertaining to prayer. But Chaneh herself couldn't have joined the minyan. Does it mean that Chaneh was inferior to some ignorant person who was counted among the ten? Not at all. In categories, in common sense categories, yes. But in strict halachic categories, in the strict original halachic categories, is the fact that women cannot be counted as the tenth person, tenth or the ninth, as a member of the congregation, has absolutely nothing in common with the axiological problem of equality of male and female. The trouble now is that many people
Since to be a lamb is very hard, and you have to work very hard on it, so many people is ready to exchange lamb for common sense categories. Now let me explain. The adherence of the common sense halacha, no matter what you call it, whether you call it meaningful halacha, creative halacha, new halacha, I mean, there are quite a variety of terms. I'm never impressed by terms and cliches. But actually what you want is common sense halacha. I'm misled by a basic philosophical doctrine containing half-truth and platitudes. They expound since the days of Kerach. Religious subjectivism. Prima facie, it is hard to refute this theory. It was, as I told you, it was hard to refute Korach's argument of Kehol Ha'ed or Kulam Glishim. Because both arguments contain a kernel of truth. They say, and you heard it quite often, Rachmon and Libeboy, God is interested in the heart. An immense inner world. Faith, fundamentally, is an inner experience. Man, they say, meets God in the mysterious recesses of his personality. The God experience is iridescent, dynamic, bold, and breaks through the exterior of the human personality and turns into objective deeds, into action. In words, they claim, and this is the theory of philosophy of religious subjectivism, which is so popular now in the United States, I mean, it's known under the name and the trademark of existentialism, religious existentialism. In words, they say, the mitzvot manifest an inner mood, a spiritual quest, a hidden feeling of happiness or sadness. The mitzvot are supposed to reflect the inner experience. The mitzvot upon them are external correlates which run parallel to the experiential order. Each experience has its external correlate in the form of action. If this theory, they argue, is correct, then the mitzvot has got to correspond to the mood which they are supposed to express in the most competent way. Hence, the mitzvot must avail themselves of the media of expression which are best fitted to reflect the inner experience. And they argue, the scholars live in a world of abstractions, cannot determine the redemptive power of mitzvot. Only a common sense approach is capable of gauging the therapeutic energy of each mitzvah and to utilize it in the most efficient manner. Korach said to Moses, the blue thread was meant as a reminder to make us think of something, of distance, infinity, of the mysterious link between the blue sea and the blue sky. Why is it necessary to limit this symbolism to a thread and not extend it to the whole garment? From the standpoint again of common sense, halacha, Kirach was right. A beautiful purple robe may have a greater impact upon the individual than a single thread. I agree with the preamble of this theory.
Only with the preamble.
That there are two parallel religious orders in Judaism. The objective and the subjective. Judaism, in my opinion, consists of two things. Divine disciplines, call it Shochanor, or any other name, and the great romance between finitude and infinity, between God and man. We have a score in our Tanakh, in our canon, which deals exclusively with this great romance. You mean Shasha. Both deed and experience are inseparably united. The deed without experience is an incomplete act, an imperfect gesture, no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, whatever I say in this context is correct from the viewpoint of strict halachic thinking. The question is, it's very easy to say, that Judaism consists of a double order, sort of an external order of action, of deeds, or divine disciplines, and an inner experience, or an inner feeling of love for Kodesh Baruch Hu, for God. The question is, you have to prove it. Is Allah cognizant of experiential moments? And the problem is, you cannot just say, because I like it, or because if I like it, or people will come to listen to me. How can we prove it that Allah is interested in experience? Exactly, because certain mitzvahs consist in experience. And I am not referring to the mitzvah of love of God or the mitzvah of love of man. I am referring to ritual mitzvahs. For instance, the Kriya Shema. Kriya Shema, even though it is strictly identified with the recital of a certain fixed and standardized text. However, the Kima mitzvah is Kima Balev, is an experience. The same is true of Tfilah, Avedo Shalev. The same most probably is true of Avelis. The same is true of Simchas Yontif. Notwithstanding the halachic requirement for the recital of standardized text or the observance of external rites, the mitzvahs are consummated, like Avelis, Krishna, Tzilah, and realized in an experience. In other words, even the formal abstract halacha knows of the experience as an important part of the religious gesture. However, and here we reach the boundary, the religious experience is not the primary gesture. It is the secondary. The point of departure must never be the inner subjective experience, no matter how redemptive it is, no matter how colorful it is, no matter how therapeutic it is, no matter how great the impact the experience has upon the total personality of man. It should never be the point of departure. The point of departure must always be the objective external act. The objective act does not symbolically express or interpret the experience. Here they made a mistake. The reverse is true. The experience interprets the act. There are a variety of reasons justifying our thesis concerning the supremacy of the act over the feeling. The supremacy of the solid religious reality or over the emotion. First reason is the religious emotion is changeable, volatile, and transient, like another emotion. Second, each individual experiences God, man, and the world at the religious level in a unique fashion. If the religious act would have to adjust itself to the inner feelings of man, we would have to invent a constantly changing ritual
what the appropriate medium is today will be absolute, or the appropriate medium of expression is today will be obsolete tomorrow. What is good for me does not behoove my next door neighbor. There would be, if the religious experience were the point of departure, and the religious act would have to correspond to the experience, there would be a variety of symbolic action. We could not speak of a monistic service of God. This kind of ever-changing worship is idolatrous, basically. Interesting is the Rashi Kirach. Roma Meshele Kirach. If the Jehovah Yeshlem Elohus Harbe, the pagans have many gods. Kiyanim Harbe, many priests. Vavidis Harbe, in many forms of worship. Ronu, Yeshlonu, Kirachot, we have one God. Kein Echot, one high priest. Vavidu Achas, one form of worship. Monistic worship is constant. And monistic worship is not exposed to the winds of change. There is another reason for giving priority to the act over the experience. It is simply impossible to determine what is what and who is who. We can never determine what is a religious experience in contradistinction to a hedonic, mundane experience. We know of many non-religious emotions, hedonic emotions, which are provided with enormous power. They are hypnotic and at first glance redemptive. One may easily confuse the religious drive with the love impulse. It is quite normal to replace the religious ecstatic craving with the aesthetic yearning of the artist. There are common characteristics in both of them. The quest for exaltedness and infinity is typical of both, of the experience of beauty and the religious experience. To substitute secular for religious emotions is again an idolatrous method. The pagans of old used to indulge in hypnotic orgiastic ceremonials and mistakenly identifying them with the religious experience. The Torah prohibited idolatrous practices to be introduced in the ritual and service of God. Echo Yavdu Agim Oilasalayim, Vese King Amoni, Leisase King Oilashamakacho. How did these nations serve their God? Even so will I do likewise. Thou shalt not do so unto the Lord, thy God. The Torah had exactly in mind the idolatrous, uninhibited, frenzied, hedonic experiences which the pagans engaged in, confusing them with the religious experience. The rousing of religious awareness by confronting it with the powerful hypnosis of the aesthetic experience, such as music, plastic art, architecture, is alien to halachic Judaism. For instance, take the organ as an instrument. What's the purpose of the organ? What's the purpose of the organ? Where is the organ serves the purpose. What's the purpose of the organ? Prepare a mood. Yeah. The organ does not prepare a religious mood, because the organ itself is an instrument not of religious experience, but of the artistic experience. So use an artistic experience in order somehow to pave the way for religious mood. The religious mood will never come. The way will be paved by an aesthetic experience. The same is true if you dance. Their dance may rouse. May rouse it personally. Of course. Yes, it's stimulating. The rhythm itself is intoxicating. But all The rhythm of dancing is a secular experience. It's not a religious experience. It's an aesthetic experience. You expect that the aesthetic experience will pave the way for a religious experience which will follow the aesthetic experience. That will never happen. Will never happen then. Particularly, and that is basically idolatrous. And in my opinion, that is the real reason for the elimination of the organ from the service, or the non-introduction of the organ into the service. You have to want that, and I'll tell you so what, that the religious experience be born in a world of its own, not stimulated or roused by a secular, mundane, hedonic experience. And of course, and if we use as a stimulate the love experience, then it becomes abominable. Yes, this is idolatry par excellence. The religious experience is born within the religious awareness, not under the pressure of physiological carnal drives, not even provoked by spiritual needs of the human personality, such as the need for beauty. The same purpose served the architecture of the cathedrals in the Middle Ages, and in particular the Gothic architecture. I mean, whoever is acquainted with Spengler's book, I mean, The Decline of the Abend of the Western World, the West, how he interprets and is writing that, to the Gothic experience, the Gothic cathedral, we wanted to arouse in the human personality and the experience of infinity, of boundlessness, of questing, I mean, up into the heavens. Of course, perhaps it may actually provoke such an experience, produce such a quest, but it is an artistic quest, it's not a religious quest. And to substitute an artistic quest for a religious quest is idolatrous. You know very well, never mind it, now people speak about architecture of synagogue. There was no architecture of synagogue. We never cared about it. The Jewish synagogue was a plain hole. We never tried to influence the Jew by bringing him into surroundings suggesting a transcendental order or otherworldliness. We never tried to do it. Catholics, yeah. The whole mass, the music, I mean, the architecture. Yeah. Are geared to that purpose, to stimulate in the person an aesthetic experience, hoping that by this stimulation, the worshipper will also be aroused to a religious experience. And this is absolutely wrong. The religious experience is autonomous, free and original, moves at its own tempo, within its own unique orbit. This kind of independent experience follows, you know, when? Follows the deed instead of preceding it. To pray, and after prayer, to engage in a dance or in a song, it's okay. However, to dance in order to pray is futile, because one will never pray. Yahadus expected the religious experience to follow the religious act. The great romance follows the divine disciplines, not the reverse. Misha said, if one fulfills mitzvah sittes, then a glance at the thread, at the purple thread, will produce in him perhaps the experience of infinity. If you proceed from action to experience, then the purple color will remind you of the mystery of existence and our link with God. However, if one fails to conform
to the halachic norm. And contrary to the rules of halacha, avails himself of a common sense approach, the looking or the glancing at the tchilas will not produce any reaction. And if a response will be forthcoming, it will be a mundane hedonic response, not a religious response. It will not enhance my religious experience. Blue, experience of blue, if it follows the Kiyum HaMitzvah, is a great experience. But experience of blue, without the Kiyum HaMitzvah, can produce in a vulgar association, vulgar memories, unredeemed experiences. When I hear people talk about meaningful halacha, the unfreezing of the halacha, empirical halacha, I know what the people have in mind, by all their jargon. They have in mind exactly what Kirach and his adherents had when they approached Moses with the problem of Talish Kulatchilas. They wanted a common sense interpretive approach to halacha. They simply had no patience to study, to get the proper training, and to master the unique halachic methodology and logic. They rebelled against the institution of Lomdes. They want to do to halacha what Aristotle did to physics, to convert it into a shallow discipline, replete with platitudes and commonplace ordinary opinions. Of course, Moshe won. The Kira group finally admitted that Moshe MS it was MS. We still study the halacha in light of Moshe's esoteric conceptualizing logic. The masorah of method, of halachic structures and a priori construct will continue forever. The Ikter Olav, Ktir Samim, Babeker, Betives, Aniris, Yafterenu, Ubaalei Sarin Esaneres, Ben Arboim Yafterenu. And Aaron shall burn thereon incense. Every morning he dresses the candles, he shall burn it. And when Aaron lights the candles, the lamps, the dusk, he shall burn it. The burning of the incense and the lighting of the lamps will be emerged by the Torah in the one mitzvah. As a matter of fact, we have a study scotching, and the scotching well knows a very separate view of combining that locus and ears with actor factors. There is a separate view of lighting the candles almost simultaneously with the burning of the Torah. What does that locus and ears signify? Light, understanding, knowledge of the Torah, clarity of concept, and the depth of halachic analysis, the clear deed, the intelligent kafana. What does Kteres represent? The hidden and the intimate, the mysterious magnum of creation and the mysterious tremendum of divine presence in creation and beyond. The chisra anana Kteres as a kaperes, and the cloud of incense may cover the heart. Kteres tells us a great story of human craving for God, his questing and yearning for the origin, for the makor, for the beginning of all. Kteres, the symbol, tells us a marvelous story of human tragic waiting for an ecstatic unity with the Almighty. A colorful religious experience is represented by Kteres. A clear, intelligent religious thought and intelligent action is represented by the candles, by the menorah. The Torah, however, admonished us that the burning of the incense be coordinated with the lighting, the mystery of feeling with the clarity of thinking and acting, the excitement and passion of craving be united with the serenity and peace of halachic comprehension and halachic implementation. Both are necessary. Yes, there is a parallel order, of experience and deed, of romance and discipline, of thought and feeling. Yes. Necessary, yet Kteiros cannot be separated from Adlokas on earth. The subjective must never be isolated from the objective. And the recent Schartem cannot be severed from the Psyotrilus. The Allahic detail and Allahic precision is necessary if one wants to attain a great, colorful religious experience.
Another minute. I want to ask you, the organ and country's addiction to the other.
Thank you very much.
What about the music?
I expect it was good.
Well, I wish.